This is a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. You're listening to the UAE's number one talk radio station.
This is Afternoons on Dubai Eye 103.8.
You're listening to Afternoons with Helen Farmer podcast. I'm Poonam Verma. I talk to Mrs. India Planet on the show today. She is a lady who went from being in PR and decided to become a model in her 40s. Also, we'll find out how to use your voice properly with Lisa Hugo, who is a voice coach. Dr. Sarah is talking about hate following, meaning do you hate somebody but you still follow them online? And why do we do that? Professor Dame Heather McGregor is with us and she's giving us some top financial tips. And Dr. Neil Hopkins is talking about pressure on parents onto their students during the exam times. Mrs. India Planet 2023 is sitting in front of me. Welcome to the show, Tasneem Reza. How are you?
Thank you so much, Poonam. I'm very good and very happy to be here.
Well, it is a pleasure to meet you. And I have to ask you, I've never heard of Mrs. India Planet. I'm sure so many people out there haven't. What is it?
It is a new platform. It was in the third season that I participated. And now we are auditioning for the season four. Look, pageantry, right from the time it started, like you said, has been a beautiful business. And now, because of how accepted it is, how empowering it is to a lot of women, there are many different agencies that are coming up with pageants like these. Gleam Diva is the agency, which is a modeling and a pageant founder out of India, out of Delhi, that developed this platform. It was in the third season, like I said, that I participated. And a very, very beautiful platform. They also launched their first international platform called Mrs. World Queen that I became the title holder of.
So you hold two titles.
I hold two
titles.
But
you didn't even walk in with a crown.
I have it with me.
Do you have a crown? Oh my goodness, let's take a picture.
Okay. I will, yeah. It is beautiful. The crown is
so
lovely.
So you won two titles.
I won two titles. The first Mrs. World Queen 2023 title. They launched that with me when I entered the pageant. Yeah. They were planning to do an international title as well. And when they saw me and they went through the entire pageant for Mrs. India Planet, but then they decided to go live with this as well. They did a little pageant interview, etc., for Mrs. World Queen and decided to hand me that title.
Okay, so growing up, you know, we used to hear a lot about these Miss World pageants and how, you know, you have to be single, you have to have a certain weight, a certain height. You know, it was quite, you know, I won't say the word, but it was, you know,
restricting, maybe?
Yeah, that's the right word. Okay, we'll go with that. So what makes Miss India Planet different? Is it more inclusive in so many ways?
It is so inclusive. It really is. Not just Mrs. India Planet. I believe that a lot of different platforms like these are becoming more inclusive. There is, in fact, many different types of pageants now for different genders as well in India and globally.
Okay.
So this pageant is open to women of all ages. In fact, I just auditioned last week as part of season four, a woman of 66 years old.
Wow.
A gynecologist, so inspiring. Her story was beautiful, ready for a new challenge at this age in her life. So we do have all kinds of women from all walks of life. We have all sizes, shapes, heights, ages, etc. Women who speak English, Hindi, any other language from India. So it is a very inclusive platform focusing on beauty from within, really.
So what is the general process? Let's say you put an application form in, you send your photo. Well, what happens exactly? And what are they looking for?
They are looking for women who are ready to challenge themselves, who are ready to grow and embrace themselves and set an example for others as well. The process is very simple. For me, it was at least very simple. This pageant truly landed on my plate. It's like the universe made it happen. I landed up with a link from a friend's mother who always forced me to go in for the Mrs. India pageant. She believed I could do it. And one night she sent me a link and I said, okay, let me just register. And I registered, went to sleep. The next thing I know, I've been invited for an audition. I said, okay, let's go for it. I auditioned. And the next thing you know, I've been accepted. And that's when I sat and thought about it, whether I want to go ahead and what that means for me and whether I want to do it. I, of course, decided to go for it and won it. And it turned out to be the most beautiful experience, honestly. I not only won a crown, as I say, I gained a lot of confidence and won a lot of friends.
So. It's funny because my old school brain is going back to thinking, God, if I did that, I'd be like, do I need to prance around in a bikini now in front of everybody?
No, those days are gone. Exactly.
So let's talk about what you were doing before this, because you were in a normal PR job, am I correct?
Yes. Okay. I was, in fact, sitting right across your building.
You were?
Yeah.
So we probably emailed each other then, if you were in PR.
Many times.
For sure. So tell me what was going on. Was life going good, and did something just shift in you?
Life was going wonderfully. I did have some wonderful jobs, and I'm still very, very grateful for them. But yes, something did shift internally. I, for the last, I would say, 5 to 6 years, felt truly a need to do more with my life. You know, corporate is a blessing. A lot of us are in need of that job, and I was, of course, and continue to be in need of the job. You do need the financial support, right? But sometimes that 9 to 5 can really drain you of your energy.
You.
It drains you of your life, of your joys, of what your passions are, really. And I had so many passions that I wanted to explore, and I just didn't have the time for it. I didn't have time for my kids or for my family. And PR can be a very stressful job too. So I was just working nonstop, and I felt like I didn't have a life. So I wanted to get to a place where I could earn more freedom of time and joy in life, I guess. So began with a little bit of planning with my husband, whose support wouldn't have, I mean, without his support, it wouldn't have happened. So you need someone on your side, I would say. Just a few months of preparation to say that, hey, listen, if we don't earn even a zero dirham for the next 6 months, we should be okay. And if nothing works out, I'm going to go back into a corporate job. I didn't even have a plan. I just said, I need to leave. I need this to end, and I need something else to happen in my life.
Yeah.
Maybe it's a coming of age at 40 or midlife crisis, I'm not sure. But
oh, I think those happen every couple of years. There's no such thing as a midlife. I think life just hits you, and I think you're in a very good supportive situation where you had a husband to support you.
Absolutely.
But, you know, I have a friend of mine who's in her late 40s, and she said she was very ambitious, beautiful. She's still modelling too. And she said, I feel like I've lived a life wasted. And that really hurt my heart, because there were so many things she wanted to do and life took over, or her husband wasn't as ambitious as she wanted to be. So she, you know, supporting the children. And that made me sad listening to that.
It does make you sad. I had a similar feeling. I felt like I was living the same day over and over again. And my years were merging into each other. There was just nothing. It's not that it's not exciting. You still have a wonderful life and you're very grateful for it.
Do you know, it's funny. I look at my mom and I look at her, and she was from a generation where she was so happy being at home, taking care of the kids, and she loved it. I don't know if that's something I could do all the time and be content, especially when we're all driven differently. You could still be a mother and still, you know, love your children, but there's still things that you want to do.
I'll tell you what it is. I think we all long deep down within for a sense of freedom, for a sense of being able to make a choice,
I like that.
For ourselves, say no to what we don't want to do or which doesn't resonate deeply within us. And sometimes a corporate job doesn't allow you that. Mm. It is restricting. It is you're working to make someone else's dream come true, not yours. So,
God, that's so true.
Right?
So true.
Yeah.
But that's how we get into the rat race. And then you have to pay the bills, and then you have to pay the school fees. And then how do you get out of it?
It is hard to get out of it. It took my husband and I several years of building courage and planning and talking about it. Endless conversations over long walks till we finally got to a place where I think we said, OK, now we've got to put action behind our words, walk the talk and make it happen. And then we'll see where it goes. So here I am a year later, and I am blessed and very, very happy to be here.
Okay, well, we're going to come back with Tasneem, and I need you to put your crown on if you've got it, just so
yes.
I can know I'm talking to Miss Planet, of course, Miss India Planet with us. I've never spoken to a real pageant winner sitting with a crown in front of me. It looks stunning. It looks beautiful on you. Is that heavy?
It is slightly heavy. Not if you wear it for a few minutes, but yeah, if you're wearing it for a few hours, then it tends
okay. to be. Well, I'll only be wearing it for like a minute, just for the pictures, just for the gram.
Yeah, you're
okay.
Most welcome.
How did your family feel when you said you wanted to enter this and then when you won?
I come from a very traditional family back at home. We didn't, you know, so I wanted
parade
to be a model.
Yourself, yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So when I was 16, I wanted to be a model, but this wasn't something I could even think of or
dream
of.
Same with me. In my culture, yeah. I wanted to be a singer. My mum's like, nah, we don't do that.
Yeah, we don't do that. So I went down the traditional route, you know, what's expected of me, what the society expects, what community expects, what family expects. I did that until I know it wasn't making me happy anymore. I was a bit worried that my father and my mother wouldn't really support this and how they would feel. But honestly, Poonam, I was so overjoyed because they showed immense, immense, immense love and support.
Yeah.
And of course, my husband, who truly encouraged me. I wouldn't have done this. He pushed me and he encouraged me. My kids, they were convinced I'm going to win. When I called them and I said, hey, I've won. Of course you've won. They didn't even say congratulations. Of course you won. We always knew you would. So they were so sweet and supportive. And my friends, everyone, you know, who they were just overjoyed at the fact that I was doing this. So
has this given you a different sense of confidence that you didn't have before in any way?
100%. Because I had an immense stage fright being in PR. That may be surprising, but I couldn't voice myself in a group of people. Forget, let alone.
We have a voice coach sitting right there. She's on next, so we need
amazing.
To get you two together.
Amazing, yes. I was terrified of speaking in front of people. And that's something I worked on for many years in my PR job. But standing in front of a huge audience and being put on the spot with a Q&A was something I was so terrified of. And the fact that I did it,
yeah.
I walked away feeling such a sense of achievement. And that's when I truly knew, hey, you know what? Why are you afraid? What are you afraid of? You can do this. You've got this. So I walked away with an immense sense of confidence.
So you know, I train a lot of people when it comes to presenting on camera. And I always say, whatever you think you're critical of yourself, we don't notice it until you point it out.
Yeah.
Everyone's really more concerned about how they come across. You know, that's the main
that
thing.
That is true.
And really, unless you really mess up, then we notice it, like Steve Harvey on Miss Universe. Okay, we won't talk about that, but you know, he messed up big time.
Yeah.
So what happens now? You've won. How has it impacted your life? Are there new opportunities? Do you go onto a bigger platform?
There have been several new opportunities. One being a lot of invitations to different places to actually to be in a spot where you judge and you evaluate different talent.
Okay.
So that's been fun because I've been on the opposite, on the other end of that. So that's been interesting.
Okay.
I've had the opportunity to also contribute socially a lot through this platform. For example, I was in India last month and we contributed and we volunteered with a whole group of underprivileged children, distributed stationery among them. And it was just such a wonderful afternoon that we spent with them. Things like that. There are a lot of women in this pageant who have become organ donors and have rallied up such a huge amount of support during the time that they were, participating in this pageant. So things like that mm-hmm. has really changed for me. I've also had a lot of opportunities come my way from India as well as from here.
And that's great because, you know, we always associate beauty and youth, you know, with 20-year-olds. But you're in your 40s and you've literally turned into, you know, a pageant winner twice. You're a model. It gives confidence to so many people that, you know, age,
exactly.
There is no defining time for age, really.
Absolutely. When I started out, I wanted to set that example for my kids. I didn't want them to live the life where they do what society expects of them and just because they've done it for a few years feel like they are compelled now to do it for the rest of their lives.
Yeah.
I wanted them to know that it's okay. You can change your career path at any point. You can redefine success for yourself. And in doing so, maybe hopefully even inspire other women who might be stuck in their jobs or stuck in their lives and feel like they don't have a way out. But you know, truly, you do have a way out. Mm. The only person stopping you is you.
Absolutely. I've been in my way many times. As they say, get out of your own way. We sabotage ourselves. Just one final question quickly, because we've got 10 seconds. Can I enter it? Or is it because I was born in England? I am an Indian.
You can enter in. Of course, we have
you
a couple
can,
of people
from
UK
India.
There. Yes.
Okay, let's see what happens. Maybe I'll boost my confidence.
Woo-hoo,
and I will be
that would be amazing.
I'll be stealing your crown. With me now is Lisa Hugo. She's a voice and performance coach, and you also used to be a professional singer. Now, Lisa, am I correct when saying your diaphragm is the key to breathing and breathing is the key to your voice?
100%.
I didn't make that up. I Googled it, so it should be right.
It is true.
So tell me a little bit about yourself first before we talk about your voice coaching.
Okay. Well, I come from a performance background. As you heard, I studied musical theatre. I was a professional singer for many years of my life. And I always dabbled in voice coaching on the side, because if you're a performer, you always need some kind of a backup to supplement your income. And then when I arrived here in Dubai, which was 18 years ago, I had young children. I was a mum, and I didn't want to do performing so much anymore. So I gravitated towards coaching voices, mostly with singers. And in the last 6 to 8 years, I'd say I have transitioned into working more with executives and leaders, entrepreneurs, speakers, performers, presenters, to help them to find the full power and potential of their voice, to be better in their presenting skills, so that they can show up as an authority and show credibility.
Now, I didn't know I had a thing for voices. And when I say a thing, what I mean is that when I look back in my life, when I listen to meditations, I like female voice. I don't know why. I remember when I met a guy and I thought he was very cute, and he left a voice message on my phone and I thought, oh, I don't like his voice. How much does the voice play a part in how much you know, people warm to you generally?
It's huge. How we sound is how people will perceive you, whether they find you likable, believable, trustworthy, whether you're passionate about what you do, and it even connects in a relationship on love.
I mean, and if you look at someone like David Beckham, growing up in England, they would always take the mickey out of his voice, so he hardly spoke. And I used to think, oh my God, I'm glad he's a good footballer because he's really bad at talking. And he probably is a nice, intelligent guy.
Probably, yeah. Okay. I don't really follow the football, and yeah, I know all of him.
But his voice is known for being really odd, especially when he was growing up. So let's talk about, when I used to do singing, not as professionally as you, I remember I wanted to do, you know, pop music and R&B. So my mom said, you better go and practice your voice with a vocal coach. I didn't realise how difficult it was. I didn't realise how badly I was using my voice, how I was breathing wrong, and how powerful my voice was, but it was so restricted because I didn't know how to use it. Now, first of all, we all talk on a daily basis. Are we generally not using our voice to its full potential when we talk?
I would say the majority of people are in that category, not using their full potential. A lot of people are breathing shallow. And when you breathe shallow, all of a sudden your voice comes out very weak and very soft and airy. And you feel short of breath all the time as well. That's something a lot of people say to me. Yeah, I'm always short of breath. That's because you're not breathing and not supporting your voice.
So they say, you know, breathe from your stomach and go up and talk out. I mean, I can't do that on the radio all the time, breathe from there. How do we do this? Little tips or exercises?
It becomes instinctive. If you train it, it's something that you don't think about anymore. You just do it. So I'm sitting here and I can feel my stomach is squeezing gently. And then the minute I need to take a breath, it relaxes and I've got breath back. But I'm not lifting my shoulders.
I see.
It's deep.
So you have to practice it. Yeah. What are some of the most common problems when it comes to speech with people?
Oh, there are a lot. And everybody's going to be different and have their own nuances. So you've got clarity in your voice, people who mumble. You've got strong accents in this region, people who, you know, where the accent is interfering with the ability to speak. I don't ever think that someone should take their accent away because it's part of your uniqueness and who you are. But if it's interfering with the ability for people to understand you, then you need to do some changes and soften things down. Mm. And then you've got the soft voice, which has got too much air. And then you've got edgy voices. There's so many different characteristics, nasal sounds and edgy or heavy sounds. People who speak always very loud. I don't want to blow the microphone here. Yeah, so lots of different idiosyncrasies that people will have.
But is it easy to change your voice to make it sound, let's say, more confident or less monotone? Or are you stuck with the one you're born with and develop throughout your childhood? Like how much can we change it?
Right. So that was an interesting point that you said, is that you're stuck with the voice you're born with. No, but we learn to speak by mimicking. We learn to speak by the influences that we grew up with. And if you grew up with somebody who had a very strong voice, your parents were good speakers, and the chances are you will grow up to also be a very confident and well-spoken person. But if you had parents or teachers or influences that had other, you know, problems in their voice. But I'm not going to say problems, but they weren't so strong. Mm. Then you probably will mimic that as well. But yes, you can change it. Yes, you can change the way you speak by learning to use your voice from the right place, understanding how your voice works and working with someone who can help you.
So Mark Lloyd here, he's been the longest serving presenter on the station. And every time I sit with him and present, he will still, before he goes on air, go loosening those lips. And he does it all the time.
Like, that's awesome.
It is awesome. But what does that do for you? Does it just relax the mouth? Because
Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you. It's called a lip roll. And it's, I would say, multifaceted in what it does. When you do this kind of exercise, yeah, rolling out your lips, the first place you engage is your core. So you're engaging your breath.
Let's do that together. So you're saying from the core, let's go. Yeah, I can feel
you
it.
You can feel your core is working strongly.
Yeah.
And the next thing is you can't create that sound without having a relaxed upper body. So your throat muscles, your facial muscles, your lips, they're all extremely relaxed. And that means your vocal cords are free to work the way they naturally want to work without any interference.
And what can we do? Let's say I feel like I put pressure on my voice. I don't know why on my vocal cords, because I'm not breathing from my stomach. Is there anything we can do to relax the vocal cords on a daily basis?
Oh, there's lots of different exercises, yes. It mostly comes, again, through your breathing. When your breath is grounded, then your vocal cords can stay relaxed. But the minute your breath is not grounded, or you're holding your breath when you speak, then all of a sudden you can hear tension in the voice and it doesn't come out naturally and free.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I kind of like it though. I mean, I've had a bit of a cold and cough, and I kind of like it sometimes when my voice gets really, like, you know, seductive sounding, because it sounds like late night love radio station, you know, that kind of thing. So I do like certain tones, but I have sometimes a strong accent, which is quite a Birmingham accent. I hear that things like milk are quite heavy for the vocal cords. Anything we should avoid or take?
Dairy products, as you said, they will clog up the throat.
Yeah,
but mostly, you know, unless you have an allergy, most things are not going to connect with your vocal cords. So people think if I have honey and tea and they're not going to get to your vocal cords. They'll soothe the sore throat in the back of the mouth.
Yeah.
But the vocal cords are in your windpipe. So anything that you drink is not going to get to your vocal cords except for hydration, which will be several hours later.
So how much water do you drink then?
I try to get down 3 litres a day.
Oh my goodness. All right, don't even get a half litre. Let's do a little exercise for everybody, right? So if you're driving in your car, you're sitting at home, what are we going to do? We're going to do something called sirens.
A siren, yep.
So we're not going to be like police car sirens?
A little bit like that.
Oh, okay.
Absolutely. Take it back to your childhood. Experiment.
Okay. So what do we do and what does this do for the voice?
Well, we're just going to go all the way up and all the way down in our range. And what that's going to do is stretch out your vocal cords and explore both your chest voice, your middle voice, and your head voice.
And when we do we breathe from our stomach?
Yes.
Okay, so if you do the first example, then we'll do it together.
Okay, so you get the breath in, and we're on a wee or a woo. Woo, woo, woo.
Okay.
Woo.
All right, let's do this together, everybody. Are you ready? 3, 2, 1.
Ooh.
My boss is like, what is going on in the studio? But it's true. So you can make any sound with your mouth and do it like E, R, ooh.
Well, actually, interesting, when you said E, you pulled right back, but your E should be more close to an ooh, E.
Okay.
Yeah. When you go E, E, you pull the sound right back in your throat and it sounds very harsh.
I need to practice. Okay, let's talk about coaching, because you coach a lot of people. Who comes to you and what are they looking for?
Right. So right now I'm focused on executives, leaders, entrepreneurs, and people who need to use their voice professionally, but they struggle with confidence, they struggle with how they sound, they can't deliver with an impact, maybe they're monotone, boring, and they need to learn some solid skills to be able to present well. And I teach all the stuff that I learned in the theatre world and being on stage for so many years.
But sometimes I feel like a lot of people come to me and say, how do I project my voice without sounding like I'm shouting? What do you suggest for that?
again, I'm sorry, but it comes down to your breath.
Everything's to do with your breath.
It's the foundation of all good speaking.
So Lisa says, I have a very soft, gentle voice, and I want to start my own podcast talking about legal issues as I'm a lawyer. But I feel people won't take me seriously as my voice isn't very loud, strong, or authoritative sounding. Any advice?
Okay. Well, you still need to be authentic to yourself. So if you are also personality-wise maybe a bit softer, then you can still present that. And when you're on a podcast, you have a mic.
Yeah.
So that mic will be able to be amplified and pick up all the qualities in your voice. But if you do want to strengthen your voice and have more control, and I think that's the issue, having more control, then you need to learn how does your voice work. And that's what I teach my clients, where, you know, where does the voice come from? Treat it as if it's a musical instrument, because it is a musical instrument. So understanding the breath management, relaxing your vocal cords, and resonance and forward placement.
How does living in this kind of desert climate and the AC affect our voices?
It dries us out. Hence, we have to drink the 3 liters of water a day.
That's really good. Any little home remedies you can give us? I mean, we know the honey and the lemon, but you're saying it's not affecting our vocal cords. But anything else that we can use at home?
There is one product on the market, which is called Vocal Zone, and if you are suffering with a sore throat or you feel your voice is a bit hoarse, this is quite a magic little lozenger. I'm not sure where you can buy it here in the UAE, but I bring them in from the UK. And I think there are some places now that stock it. Have a look on Amazon.
Or good old gargle with salt.
All that, yeah.
All that.
But again, that's a sore throat. Yeah. That's going to help with inflammation, but it's not really going to get to your vocal cords.
All right, just more sirens along the way. Okay, so how can people contact you if they want to book you for a coaching session as well?
Okay, they can go to my website, lisahugo.com. Okay. And I've also got the podcast, Impact Through Voice. And my Instagram is lisahugoofficial.
Okay, Lisa, thank you so much. So joining me now to break down all this online hate is psychologist Dr. Sarah Ramsby from the Thrive Wellbeing Centre. How are you, Dr. Sarah?
I'm good. How are you?
Long time no speak. Everything good in your life?
Yes, I can't complain. How about you?
Yeah, everything is fine. Now, I haven't heard of hate following. Describe to me, what does it look like online? What exactly is it?
It's exactly what it sounds like. It's when you follow someone, whether you've clicked the follow button or not, but you're monitoring that person and it's someone that you can't stand. They might be someone you know, someone in your circle, social circle, past or present, or someone that is a celebrity that you don't actually know in your personal life.
Okay, so we've had two texts telling me which celebrities, you know, they hate following. Aldwin says Andrew Tate. And the next one, there's no name on this, but I totally agree with this, and that's the Kardashians. It's, you know what I mean? I kind of think everyone can remember. Mine is Chrissy Teigen. Who's yours?
To be honest, I don't really hate follow anyone, and that's because I've been really using my social media in a very mindful, professionally oriented way. So I can't say that I do. That being said, one of my best friends definitely shoots over screenshots from time to time, and we engage in a little bit of banter around that.
So why? Okay, there's extreme versions where you're getting hated comments, trolls, and then there's the minor ones where you're like, oh, they annoy me, but let's see what they're doing, right? So why do these people trigger us? Why are we angry or envious? What is it?
So we engage in this hate following for a number of reasons. One of the primary reasons is that we're bored, we're online, and it's something to do. The other part of it is something I alluded to a moment ago, and that's it's an opportunity sometimes for us to bond with someone else. Hey, did you see what this person is doing? Did
so
you see
true.
What this person is wearing? Mm. And it provides us that opportunity for social connection. The other more social psychological explanations for why we do it include that it teaches us a little bit about ourselves, because ultimately when we hate follow, we're engaging in social comparisons.
Mm.
According to psychologists, we have two types of social comparisons. So we either compare ourselves upward, so to people that we think are better than us on a particular domain, or we compare ourselves downwards to people we think are worse than us on a certain domain. So if you're engaging in hate following and you're looking at someone and thinking, oh, they've got terrible style, they're such show-offs, they're not particularly intelligent, that gives us information about what's important to us. And it also makes us feel good about ourselves if we believe that we possess those characteristics that they lack.
This is exhausting when I'm thinking about what you're saying, to be honest with you, because it makes me think, well, who do I watch and who am I criticizing and why am I criticizing them? So it's really turning turning everything onto myself, which is making me tired thinking about it. What are you doing to me? It used to be fun before when we used to do stuff online. Now I feel like it's gone even deeper and darker. What would you say?
I would say that hate following is okay if it's not bothering you and if it's something that's providing a source of entertainment. When we think about psychology and mental health, usually what we're looking at is when something begins to become distressing. So if you're engaging in this and you're having a bit of a laugh, you're enjoying doing it with a friend, it's not keeping you up at night, it's not making you feel bad about yourself or insecure, then by all means, go ahead.
Yeah. I mean, I took on this thing a couple of months ago, or no, about a year or two ago, where somebody told me, it was a friend, she said she posts due to her work. She needs to. She's an author and everything and a speaker. But she goes, I like to post and ghost. And I said, what's that? And she said, I'll put what I need to for my own benefit for work, but I don't need to look at everybody else's lives. And that just really stuck with me. And I was in England for 5 weeks. Nobody cares about Instagram. They just don't care where I come from. They just have normal lives. And because maybe we're in the media, we have to put it up. And it was so nice. I didn't care what anybody was doing because there was nothing to post and nothing to I was not intrigued by anything. And coming back here, I've like, I'm still in that kind of mentality. And I feel like, I feel quite relaxed, really. And I've realized how very inauthentic a lot of people are. And I will give you an example. I was on the plane and there was a beautiful young lady sitting next to me and dressed up lovely. And we didn't say much. And then she started talking to me. And she was so nice. A new entrepreneur, only 22, very engaging. And she said, oh, just follow me on Instagram, you know, if we meet up in Dubai. So I went onto Instagram. And here's my judgment. When I looked at her page, there's no way I would engage with somebody like that because it was literally pictures of herself every single day. But she was amazing. So I feel like so many people are giving mixed signals, which is why we're misjudging them.
Yeah, absolutely. The thing is when it comes to social media and particularly a picture image based platform like Instagram, it's carefully curated. And what happens is people put forward content that's in line with the persona that they are trying to build. And that is often very much disconnected from who they are in reality. And that's part of the reason that overconsumption without critical thinking and gathering external bits of information can make these platforms difficult for us. It can make using them and comparing ourselves quite painful, and insecurity can develop as a function of that.
Yeah. Dr. Sarah, let's talk first of all about the person that's being followed and hated on. Is it a good idea for them to set boundaries, block the person, or even respond?
I think it really depends, and each person needs to sit and have a think about what it is that would work well for them. I believe that most people that are large-scale influencers have experienced this, probably experience it on a regular basis, and have created some kind of boundaries, whether that is not replying, whether that is replying in a way that gently indicates that, you know, you can keep your opinion to yourself and it doesn't really impact on me, or it could be the reporting and blocking. So I don't think that there is one set solution. I think each person needs to do what feels right for them. That being said, even if this is something that influencers experience on a regular basis, and even if they are able to, for the most part, shrug it off, if you're going through this day after day, there are going to be some days where it weighs heavily on you.
Well, it's like you might have 10 positive comments and one negative, and that stays with you.
Absolutely.
And I'm not thick-skinned. I can't take too much criticism or anything. I'm overly sensitive. So there's no way I could be like continuously on Instagram and influencing and doing lots and lots of video content like those people. Do you have to have a certain kind of personality to be that big online and to want to, you know, just have that thick skin, or does it develop?
I don't know what the research around online influencers says. I think that in general, somebody that is going to want to put themselves out there, particularly on a visual platform, is likely going to be someone that is more extroverted and more comfortable with the spotlight. So there might be a little bit of a self-selection, but even the most extroverted person, even the person who is most comfortable with the spotlight, is a human at the end of the day. And whether it's a small percentage or a large percentage of people that are expressing dismay or criticism, it is going to affect you. So the boundaries and the barriers are really important. And I think sometimes it probably makes sense to engage in either a little bit of a pause or a detox, or have someone take over the account for a little while until you can calibrate.
So we've had some texts. Dan says there's a great quote by Stephen Bartlett. He said, "Maybe you've always been happy, but the world, social media and external comparisons have convinced you that you can't possibly be." I agree with that. And Sarah says there's a great button on these social media platforms and it's called unfollow. And if that isn't enough, just block the people you don't want to see. I do it all the time. So Rebecca did say on the text, "I follow Trini Woodhull and she really gets on my nerves." So how can we get her off Trini Woodhull so she's more relaxed? Any tips for the ones who are hating?
Yeah, my first tip is ask yourself why you're doing it. Are you doing it because you're bored and it's providing some form of entertainment, even if that entertainment is a little bit unpleasant? Remember, there is a comparison when it comes to the movies that we watch. Some of us really love to engage in watching horror films. Horror films are scary. They can produce negative emotions, but those negative emotions are entertaining and it is something that does bring us pleasure. So if you're one of those people who feels something and is gaining something out of doing it, then continue doing it. But if you find that you're bothered, if you find that you're feeling really negatively about yourself, that you're spending too much time and that amount of time is taking away from other interests and obligations, then it probably makes sense to restrict the amount of engagement you're having with that particular person, since cold turkey can be a little bit challenging at first, and evaluate, do I feel better? Is it more helpful for me to engage less and take it from there?
And finally, how can we then create a positive online environment?
It really depends on what it is that we're looking for. I don't think that there is a magic formula. What we need to do is use it for what it's intended, which is to connect with other people. A lot of people gain exposure to different perspectives and ideas. They are inspired by other people who maybe have a little bit more expertise or experience in something that they're interested in. If we can make sure that we're incorporating some of that into our usage of social media, we will probably have better outcomes.
Okay. Well, Dr. Sarah Rusmi, thank you so much. You can find her at the Thrive Wellbeing Center. And I promise I won't hate follow you, Dr. Sarah. Thank you so much.
This is Money Matters with National Bonds. Save, invest, prosper.
With me now is who I actually like to call the Queen. She even walks in and dresses like the Queen. She's stunning. Let me introduce you to Professor Heather, or I should say Professor Dame Heather McGregor. That's how close she is to the Queen, who heads the finance department at Heriot Watt University, Dubai. She's been on many times. And today we're going to be talking about coping with financial emergencies and financial planning, especially for different life stages. So do text us on 4001 if you have any questions. How's everything with you?
It's good. I mean, I have to say I love being in Dubai at this time of the year, although, you know, how can we have so much rain all of a sudden? But you know, rain is a bit like money. You know, you suddenly, you're not expecting something to happen and then it does.
And then it evaporates.
Well, exactly. Do you have an umbrella? I think that's the first question I was asked. Do you have an umbrella in the car?
Well, no, if you want to save the rain, like we want to save our money, we need a bucket to save that rain.
You need a bucket to save that rain. Yes, you do. And actually, there are plenty of places in the UAE where they do, of course, have rain collection and recycled places like Sustainable City and so on. So it is not the worst analogy. And I think that what we do know is, though, that rain, even though it's only 14 days a year in the UAE, it does actually happen. And so people should always plan.
Okay. Finance and money, it used to stress me a lot because for the simple reason, whenever we've talked about it at school, like the seriousness of being in the real world, how to save, how to invest, nobody even, my dad taught me how to sign a check. You know, all the basic things of learning how to survive as an adult, we're not taught them. And I still don't think we are unless you're really into it yourself. But I decided to do a Richard Branson and come to the acceptance that I'm not going to know everything. So I'll hire the people that are the experts, right? So I have like private investors now who help me and go through things like this. So should we not fear it and just use the people who do know what it is and accept how much we don't know?
Yes, and of course, you do have to be very careful when you choose, when you choose advisors. And the British press are full of stories of, you know, people who became Premier League footballers at, 17 and got massive contracts and then handed all this money to somebody who then invested it all in very dodgy places. The truth is, even if you delegate to somebody else, you need to know enough to ask the questions. So I would always encourage people to do some kind of financial literacy, you know, learn a little bit about it, enough to answer, not enough to make yourself an investor or an advisor, but enough to ask the questions. And I think that that's a very important fact, and particularly for women, might I say. Financial literacy is incredibly important.
So, you know, I went back home and, you know, a lot of people are getting older and they're talking about pensions and you kind of think, oh, it's expats. This is something that we're not thinking about, a lot of us, or it's not in place. Maybe every country has their own, you know, pension schemes and some don't. The population is growing. We're getting older. What would you say to people here when it comes to thinking forward for your money as you get older?
Sometimes people here are lulled into a false sense of security because we have the gratuity system, which means that when you leave your job, you get paid a certain amount of money for every full year that you've worked. But and also you get paid it based on your departing salary. So if you've been there for a long time, you'll get paid it based on the salary you are earning when you leave the company, not the average salary. So that's very positive. On the other hand, if you've worked somewhere for quite a few years, no one's been investing that money. It's just an IOU. So what's being introduced here is legislation to allow companies to invest that gratuity money for you go along. I think that's the biggest change we're going to see over the next year or so in the UAE.
Okay, let's say there's young 20-year-olds, 30-year-olds listening now. How would they start to take care of their money and manage it right now to serve them better in the future? Any tips?
But the first thing you need to do is start saving. And you may say, oh, I spend all my money, the rent's here so expensive, I can't possibly save. Let me give you a challenge. If you're somewhere between 20 and 30, here's my challenge to you. Just every month, put away a small amount of money. Open a savings account and put away a small amount of money. Honestly, it could be 150 dirham. At the end of the year, what's in there? When Christmas comes around or the end of the year, whatever the end of your year is, take half the money out and spend it on yourself. You'll feel great, okay? Leave half of it behind. Do it again the next year. The half will be bigger at the end of the next year. You'll be able to buy a nicer dress or a nicer handbag. And do this every single year. So save a small amount of money for a year and spend half of it on yourself at the end of the year.
Well, you know, growing up, interest rates used to be a pretty good thing when you used to, you know, invest in your banks and everything. Now they're just absolutely terrible. So people go towards property, which has always been a good investment. Not always, just
not
depends.
Not always a good investment.
Yeah.
Anybody who had lived here through 2007 to 2010 would tell you that there have been regular play times where it's gone back to zero. I think property, the first thing you should think about buying a property, you're buying something to live in. Buy something to live in first. Stop yourself paying rent. That's the first challenge, really.
What would you say about, like, I know people buying property in a country that they're not from, because who knows, they may have to go back home. Is that a good idea?
So my point about that with everybody is, where do you want to retire to? You may not know that for sure, but you can probably have a good guess. And where do you want to retire to, and then start to build assets in that country? So if you want to retire back to the UK or back to Australia, then start to build assets in Australia or in the UK. And you can do that very simply.
How?
Well, first of all, open a savings account. And the second thing is, if you're reasonably young, be investing it in the stock market. Just invest it in a fund that tracks the stock market, because over any period of time, the stock market will outperform cash.
So we've got a text saying, I've invested in stocks and shares rather than property for the simple reason I don't want to deal with tenants and the home maintenance, etc., etc. I just find the whole thing quite stressful. It's been much easier to earn money and use professional finance investors to do it for me. And I don't mind paying them a little bit because they know what they're doing. And my returns have been really good and I've been doing it for the past several years. Are there any other areas we should invest in that are easy to manage, such as that?
Well, I think the easiest investments to manage are anything over 5 years. If you're investing for over 5 years, you really need to be in the equity markets. Mm. So you need to be in the stock market. Mm. And the easiest way to invest in any stock market is just to invest in the index. So invest in a fund that just matches the index.
Yeah.
You know, so you're taking a punt on the economy of Australia or the UK or New Zealand or America. Just buy into a fund that invests broadly across the index and then forget about it. And the other thing to do, which is to do it on a monthly basis. So you can open an account and just put in a certain amount of money every month, and then they'll, regardless of the price of that fund that month, it will invest that money. So I, for instance, invest £500 every single month into a single fund in the UK. And my bank is set up to buy that £500 worth of shares every single month in that single fund, regardless of the price. So over time, it'll average itself out.
Yeah.
This is Money Matters with National Bonds. Save, invest, prosper.
Now life is full of ups and downs and emergencies happen all the time, Heather. How much should we have in an emergency fund?
Well, the perceived wisdom is that you should have 6 months of living expenses in an emergency fund. And most people I say that to say, well, that's such a lot of money, I can't imagine ever saving that up, and so on. Why should I even bother starting? But just because it's an ideal doesn't mean it's what everybody has. But having no money in an emergency fund is really not worth it. I mean, what are you going to do if the washing machine breaks down? Mm. You know, you need an emergency fund. And the most important thing about an emergency fund is it should be accessible. So it's no point investing this in stocks and shares. An emergency fund needs to be in cash in a savings account so that you can get at it really quickly.
So I know an accountant and my niece does the same. And I want to know about budgeting, because both of them basically write down every single thing they spend money on. Now, I think it's amazing, but I don't know if I have the time, or sometimes do I even save all the receipts? Is this a good thing to do? And how should we budget? Any good advice?
Well, can I own up to the fact that I am also an accountant? And, you know, it's not a disease. But the reason why is that they're doing something that I would advise everybody. If you want to be secure financially, you need to invest at least an hour a week in your own finances. And in that 1 hour a week, no, there's 168 hours in the week, that includes sleeping. And I'm suggesting that you invest an hour a week, sit down and write down what your expenses are every week. Okay. I wouldn't say write down everything you've spent all week, but what are your main expenses? What is your rent? What are your DWA bills? What are your car costs?
Yeah.
You know, create something where you understand what it costs you to live. And that way you can start to plan for if you have a problem. And then if you do hit the buffers, the first thing I would say is, if something terrible happens, you lose your job or you have to move out of your flat or something, what is the most important thing you're going to do to save money at that point? In this country, probably the quickest thing, unless you own your house, is to get out of your rental agreement and to leave your house and to go and rent something cheaper, something further away.
Yeah. So you're saying you need to see the clause in your rental agreement.
Yeah, well, what you do need to do is not say to yourself, well, you know what, I love living here, I'm going to live here as long as possible until the money runs out. The money will run out, you know, a lot quicker if you stay where you are. You know, look at what your biggest costs are and try and cut them.
Okay. Any other final advice before we let you go?
Don't let money control your life. You know, you can control it.
But, you know, you do say this, but it causes so much stress in people's lives.
That's what I'm saying. Spend an hour a week on it. You know, if you think about how much time you spend worrying about it, an hour a week on writing down what your major costs are and thinking about how you might address those is a really important hour spent.
Would you recommend any good books to read when it comes to money? Because there's so much out there online and books. Anyone that you think is really good as just advice, an expert in that area, and easy to understand as well for beginners.
Yeah. So my go-to financial columnist is Merin Somerset Webb, who is a Bloomberg columnist, and she's outstanding. She's also written a whole lot of books, and she edits something called Money Week, which I would also recommend. But, you know, even I have written a book about financial advice for women called Financial Advice for Independent Women. So, you know, it's very good. The more you read, the more you ask about it, the more time that you spend investigating money, the happier you're going to be.
And just finally, I have talked to a lot of women about this. Why do you think women are nervous about money, or they're not as astute when it comes to money with men?
I think women are every bit as astute as with money as men. I just don't think they believe they are. And that's a self-confidence issue, which would take us an entire different program. But I would, again, encourage you, you know, to think about things. The more you learn about it, the more confident you'll be.
Okay, well, it has been a pleasure as always, Your Royal Highness. I love to call her that. Dame Heather, thank you so, so much. I think I need to get some advice from you actually as well. Thank you. So exams are around the corner for so many students. Now, my niece even has her A-levels in June, and I was with her last week, and she's really calm. She's extremely intelligent, loves reading and studying, isn't on Instagram, which makes me so proud. But I'm genuinely stressed for her because I'm like, she's hiding it. She must be anxious. How can she be so calm? And as parents, you know, even as aunties like me, we want to support the kids through these important, stressful times without making them anxious too. But parents tend to be anxious, and we have to question, are we putting our anxiety onto them? We now have Dr. Neil Hopkin. He's the Director of Education at Forts Education, and he's here to offer his expertise to any parents out there who need some advice when it comes to supporting their kids through their exams. Lovely to meet you, Dr. Neil. How are you?
I'm very well. It's good to see you two here, and to see that even the aunts have got that level of anxiety. Spreading it amongst the family, I think, is very generous.
I'm even tougher than the mom. I think I stress more about it than she does. She's my little baby, really, because I don't have my own daughter, so she's mine. So I have the maths paper here right in front of me, the GCSE one.
Good luck.
Now, I did A-level maths, and this is crazy, but I failed the first time. I didn't fail. I did really bad. So I went to a smaller school, and there was four of us, and the teacher was incredible to the point that I would go home and for fun, I would do A-level maths. I loved it.
Wonderful.
I'm opening this page. I recognise a lot and I don't remember anything.
This is the thing, isn't it? Oh. It's incredible when you look at things that you think, oh, surely that's something that's quite easy to do. And I think there's a lot of chatter that's gone around over the years where we say GCSEs and A-levels, they're all getting easier. It's much easier to get this grade than it ever was in the past. And then you look at a paper and you think, I can't remember any of this. I don't know where I would start.
Is that the same kind of like equations I would have done, or have they changed and kids become more intelligent? Tell me.
Well, I'd like to think, I'm an optimist, and I like to think that children have become more intelligent, probably because people like you and I have imbued and imbibed all of the knowledge from previous years and passed them on to our children. But I think in reality, it's more that we forget. If we're not doing it every day, if we're not using that particular skill every day, of course, it evaporates, as we were just saying in the previous session with Professor Heather. Does that money just evaporate like
that? Makes
water?
Me question, why did I even do A-level maths? I couldn't even help my niece now with the GCSE paper.
Do you know, I remember sitting in a GCSE year, what's in the British system is called year 11, yeah, and saying to my maths teacher, why are we doing this trigonometry again? And he said to me, Neil, one day you're going to be in a field in a thunderstorm with a tree at one end and it's going to be struck by lightning, and very quickly you'll calculate whether to run or not. So of course my solution as a male student was to say, well, can I leave the lesson if I promise right now that if there's ever a storm, I'll just stay indoors? Anyway, that wasn't acceptable, apparently.
Oh, my God. Yeah, I'm just thinking, how many years did I waste learning things I'm not even using anymore? But it's good for the brain.
It is good for the brain. And I think that there are many things in life where, actually, if we were to design education systems, we would probably put a lot of things into the curriculum that aren't there. There are many things.
Such as what?
Well, for instance, I was just talking with Professor Heather earlier about the various things about money management that
totally.
We would put into the curriculum. But actually, these are life skills that aren't there. There are many aspects of relationship and what you do when your relationship breaks down that we would put into a curriculum.
I studied metaphysics a couple of years ago, and I remember looking at it, and it was such an easy subject about emotional stability and mindfulness. And I was like, why weren't we taught this even for a month at school? These are the skills we need. I don't know what's going on.
They are. I mean, I think what schools are trying to do now, especially here in Dubai, is to supplement the national curricula of home country systems. Mm. So at Fortis Education, we're British curriculum schools. And we supplement a lot of that curriculum with the other things that we really think children might need to know, such as entrepreneurship.
Yeah.
Or you know, financial management and a financial literacy that's really important. Or positive education and understanding character strengths. They're all things that we major on. And I think many schools are trying to do that to address this need.
What are some of the common anxieties parents feel as their children approach major exams? And are they actually justified, or are they all in our heads?
Well, I think it's a mixture of the two. I mean, certainly parents feel an anxiety because all parents, by nature of being a parent, are control freaks.
Yeah.
They like to feel that this little baby, this bundle of joy that they've had, they can control all of the good and the bad things that might happen to them throughout their life and mitigate against anything terrible happening. And of course, you get to exams and you're not in control anymore. So
wow.
A significant part of the development as a human is to become a parent and to lose that degree of control. It's a bit like when you see your child crossing the road for the first time on their own, and you realize that actually all of those lessons that you've been working on and you hope that they've absorbed actually stay and there's something that resonates with them, so they believe in it. Exams are just the same, that you can't actually ensure that they're doing it. You might send your child to their bedroom to do some revision, but you don't know really whether they're really thinking about that stuff in there or they're just daydreaming.
So it was funny. My mom said to me when I was younger, she remembers I was doing my GCSEs, and she was coming up the stairs and she literally saw me from the corner of the door go from my bed straight to the desk. And she looked at me and she said, "What are you doing?" And I said, I was just resting. She goes, "If you need to rest. Where's that pressure coming from that you think I have to be at the desk studying?"
What a great mum. That's great advice. I mean, so to look at the other half of your question, are all of those anxieties really justified? No, very often they're not. Actually, what as parents we need to be doing is bringing a sense of balance to the children. So yes, in part, we can't control what the child is doing and if they are revising. But on the other hand, we've got a lot of children that feel a great deal of pressure. Here we have a big private schooling sector that has cost parents lots of money to put their child through that education. And I don't think we can underestimate actually how much pressure they might feel about that they have to deliver. For children that are 16 years old, this is the first time they've come up against a truly international test that is going to stay with them for life. When I came here to Dubai to take up my role leading a school here, I was asked for they weren't even called GCSEs then, they were called O-levels.
Oh, yes.
I'd long since lost the certificate. Thankfully, my dad had kept the actual result sheet folded up in a little envelope, and I was able to find it in my memories box and show this, and the KHJ very kindly looked at it and said, "Okay, that's good enough." It was almost written on parchment.
Yes,
but
yes.
Actually, these exams will stay with children for the rest of their life, and that's a huge amount of pressure. So people like your mum that are able to say, actually, where's this pressure coming from? Let's try and get some balance in your life. That's fantastic parenting.
Yeah, no, she's an amazing mom. How does the stress of parents affect children? Because, you know, I've seen, like my nieces, when we were growing up, we had to do grammar school exams. It wasn't put on you, and a select few would do it, but it wasn't really a lot of pressure. Now, when I go, there's queues of kids when I drop my niece off, and you can see the nervousness of them. It's like an audition for them. And my sister-in-law says to me, she doesn't like hanging out with a lot of the mothers after school because all they talk about is, my son got this, my daughter got this. That pressure wasn't there when I was growing up. What's going on?
Well, I think when I think back about the changes in society that we've seen, if I go back 10 years, I used to talk a lot about the microwave culture and how that affects schools and the fact that we want things instantly. And I think certainly 10 years ago, that was very much something that people wanted. They wanted instant results, instant changes. And we didn't want to spend a long time cooking meals anymore. We wanted to put them in and 3 minutes later, there it was. Minimal effort, maximum output. I think things have changed. I think the zeitgeist is different nowadays. I think really what's happening is not so much about the immediacy of things, but it's actually about the comparison. And just saying, is this thing that I've got, is that as good as yours? So I'm very happy with my phone. But maybe you go out and buy the iPhone XYZ.
I'm an Android.
Sorry about that. Well, my sympathies extend to you.
Oh.
And so, you know, you get a better phone than I've got. It's got more lenses on it, or it folds out, or it does something. And then suddenly, I was very happy with my phone yesterday, but now I've seen yours and that comparison, I'm not so happy. And I think that parents, and if I may say it, the social media context that we're all working in
now.
That's
what we were talking about before.
It's led very destructively to that sense of restlessness and envy, perhaps, that we have. In some parts of the world, around the education system, it's even more marked than it is within what we see here in Dubai. For instance, before I was in Dubai, I was in Shanghai and China, and there's a system there called the Gaokao, where students at a certain age have to pass this particular qualification to be able to get into the top tiers of university at all. There's massive pressure.
I know. In that country, there definitely is.
And the results are posted on the gates outside the school. And so when on the results day, the children will gather, the parents will all gather. You're in front of your parents, you're discovering whether or not you made the cut. And so the children feel enormous pressure there. And a lot of that does come from parents. And I think we do have to, when we point the finger of blame at particular things, we do have to notice there are three fingers pointing back. And are we actually celebrating the results? If you look, for instance, at the number of GCSEs that children take, many students nowadays, and you were talking about your niece and how calm she is, many of them are taking 9, 10, 11 GCSEs. And you don't need to take that many to get into university.
I think we took 8.
Exactly. Yeah. And so actually, if you reduce the number, you could probably have more time to concentrate on your studies, maybe get better results as a result of that. Now, who's putting that pressure on? Is it the parent? Probably not. Is it the child? Maybe not. But maybe it's some strange combination of the two. Maybe it's the fact that actually a parent says, well, I noticed that Jane is actually taking 10 GCSEs. How many are you taking? Jane's mum was telling me that she's taking 10 GCSEs. How many are you taking? Oh, only 8. What do you think about taking some more? You can imagine those conversations happening. And I think there is something amongst the parent body here where we all have to actually focus on our children and calm down that comparison. Mm. And largely, that will help the psychology of the child, because really the child is worried about the comparison. Are these results going to be good enough? And basically, they ask that question that we all ask, even as adults. We say, "Is our mum or dad, are they actually going to be disappointed in me?"
So that's a really, so when I still remember mine, when I was 18, I didn't do too well in my A-levels the first time round. And I was so disappointed. I drove home hysterical. Luckily, my brother was next to me and I didn't do anything mad. So I had to drive carefully. And I got home and I didn't leave my house and I cried for 2 weeks. And everyone would come round. And all I kept saying to myself is, I'm dumb. And the pressure that we have, and it's because every one of my family friends around me going to Oxbridge, Cambridge, they wanted to be doctors, dentists. I was comparing myself and I was like, I was not good enough. And it wasn't coming from my parents. It was actually coming from me and the comparisons of myself.
Now, it's interesting, isn't it? Because as children get older and they move into young adulthood and then perhaps they become parents themselves, actually all of those values are things that they've absorbed throughout their life. So the role that a parent has right now is not just for their child age 16 or 18. Mm. It's actually for their child's child.
Oh, that's
because
so good.
Their child is actually going to take those values, and you have an opportunity as a parent to say, look, I'm not saying don't try with your exams, and I am sitting you down and I'm helping to explain to you the importance of giving your best and having a great character strength. But in reality, your child is going to raise a child.
Laura says, my child seems to be studying all the time and not taking any breaks. Now, I'm worried about burnout. Now, that is a good one, because when I was studying at university, I think I took more breaks than actually studying time. How do we find this balance?
Well, I mean, I think that's it's often a common dynamic amongst female students. Of course, this is a generalization, but we tend to find that female students will be slightly more studious, slightly more locked into that, and male students not so much. It is a generalization before anybody phones in aggrieved. But the reality is that regardless of the gender of your child, if you find that they are becoming overly anxious or are getting too plugged into to the research process, it's important that as a parent, you help them understand that they will learn best when they're refreshed. So things like mindfulness, things like taking a walk, making sure that you look away from the screen every 15 minutes and you try and defocus your eyes into the long distance, making sure that you've got a good diet and that you're sleeping well. All of these things will actually get you a better grade, because it's very easy for the children to think that, you know, if I just study for longer, then in reality, what will happen is that I'll get a better grade. But that's not the reality. It's about working smarter rather than just longer. And so having a sort of a dynamic and a plan where you'll keep working, but understanding that the work itself is actually also play, it's also relaxation, it's also sleep, it's also diet. Mm. So that's the role as a parent, really, to help the child to understand the holistic nature of what actually gets the best grade.
Yeah. Chloe, you have a question, right?
Yeah. So my brother back in Australia, he's 17, contracted by one of the rugby teams there, rugby league.
Wow.
So Australian sport. But the thing is, he can't comprehend that he needs a backup plan. So school to him just doesn't, he just goes for the social at this point. He just goes to hang out with his mates. But he just doesn't, he's never been interested. He's trains, he's the most determined kid I've ever met. He trains, he's up at 5 a.m. training until like 8 o'clock at night with school in the middle just for some fun. It's like, how do you get him to realize that you need a backup plan, you need a plan B, like, God forbid, if any injuries happen or anything like that?
But I think the thing is that the children don't just need a plan B. Nowadays, they need a plan B, C, D, E, and F, because actually the journey they're going to go on isn't like, you're practically 21, Chloe, and I'm about 1,000 years old. So, you know, in my career, when I was starting out, actually you didn't have many careers. But for younger people, they're going to go through many careers, not just the same career working for different companies. They're going to go through many different careers, completely different skill sets and professions. So actually, we've got to make sure that the children understand it's not about a backup plan. What they're doing when they're at school is they're investing in the third career, fourth career, and fifth career that they're going to have. We're going to see that. We were just talking earlier about AI and how that's going to change everything. So even if you felt you had a guaranteed great job that was going to last for life, we're going to discover other technologies coming along that will take that career away from you, and you're going to need to pivot. Now, although I'm sure your brother is highly skilled and actually might have a brilliant career ahead of him, things happen, don't they? Either to his health or to the world generally, and suddenly the plan that you had and seemed to be paved with gold disappears in front of you. The whole job of education is really about preparing children not to have a fantastic future, but to be able to react in an agile way so that when the future stops looking fantastic, they can change course and get onto a better track.
So Amina says, my daughter has a lot of extracurricular activities. Now, should I be, toning those down now because it's too much during her exams and she needs more time studying? Because obviously extracurricular activity still keeps her energy levels up and keeps her happy.
Yeah, I think it's important that the children still do that. So I would say to you, Amina, definitely keep up with the extracurricular activities. However, as with all things in life, it's all about balance and proportion, isn't it?
Yeah.
And everything in its own measure. So I think it's really important that the children understand that there are times to do it. There are times when you can be out playing soccer or tennis or running every night, But actually, in that crucial run-up towards exams, this isn't one of those times, and you're going to have to take your foot off the gas. I had to do that with my son. My son is a very keen athlete and rugby player. Absolutely loves it. That's really what he lives for, actually, to be honest. And typical of boys, of course. And so the reality is, I said to him, look, Benjamin, actually, right now, it might be madness. I know you're 16, but actually you're able to play in the under-18 yeah. squad. Maybe you take your foot off the gas a little bit and you don't play every match that's available. Yeah. So you give yourself more time. And I'm very fortunate that actually he's wise enough to listen to that counsel and ease back so he can focus more on his studies rather than necessarily the sport just now. Because in just a few weeks' time, they'll have all that time back again to be able to re-engage in the sport.
That's it.
Just invest in this moment right now.
I know. So when I used to take my breaks during exam time, like you said, you know, go for a walk or do something, I remember we'd study at university as a group like for an hour and a half, 2 hours max, and then say, right, let's all have a half an hour break. And we either have the TV or you need to go out. And we generally go out and treat ourselves to a chocolate, just have a break, have some sugar fix and come back. Now, it's so easy just to go on the phone. Now, how is that affecting them? Because they're studying intensely and suddenly they're going back on the phone and looking at screens again.
Yeah, I would say that going on the phone isn't a good idea.
Yeah.
I think that technology is pervasive anyway. I'm sure at some point we're going to look back at the invention of the mobile phone and particularly social media that lives on that. And we're going to have some serious points of reflection to decide whether or not we think that the advantages have outweighed the disadvantages or not. But I think certainly with regard to revision, it's not a good idea for the children to look at their phone, largely because of this. They're probably going to be static. They're probably going to sit somewhere.
Yeah.
Their eyes are going to be focusing about 30 or 50 centimetres away from them. It's not actually what you want for that relaxation. So really, this is about walking around. It's about breathing. It's actually about movement and getting the blood flow going again, getting some more oxygen into your brain. It's about changing the focal distance of your eyes, giving that tension around your head a little bit of a break as well. So all of those things are physiological. And it's really important that our children understand that the physiology of how they're revising has a contributory factor to the cognitive processing that they're doing as well. All of these things make sense to us as adults. But when you're 15 or 16, it's kind of difficult to understand and process, isn't
it? Oh, totally. I'm missing out on a party just because I've got to study. You know, your brain is like that. So Dr. Neil will be back with us shortly. So Dr. Neil, let's just talk about the actual day of the exam. I mean, that is where the pressure is. The night before, sleeping, walking in, you might open the paper. I've got the GCSE paper here, which is freaking me out, and think, oh, any tips, any advice for parents and the student?
I think for the students, it's about staying calm. I can remember turning over my university paper, looking at the six questions there, of which you had to answer three, and thinking, I don't know anything about any of these. I've revised for completely the wrong stuff. And you had a certain amount of time that you were allowed to walk out of the exam for like 5 minutes at the start. And after that, you had to sit it out. And it took me so long to decide that actually, in the end, I stayed for it. So I would say to all students, stay calm. Stay calm. I actually passed that exam because I cobbled together some answers. I used some logic. And actually, you don't know how every other student's going to perform. Maybe every other student is also panicking. So actually, exam results tend to be, and the governments, of course, never tell you this. The exam boards never say this. But really, they tend to be norm related. They're a standard bell curve.
Yeah.
So actually, maybe a grade C or, you know, a five that you get in GCSE, maybe that's something that in previous years you needed 70% for, but maybe this year you only need 50% because of how everybody else performs. Maybe they just set the questions slightly too hard and too high. So the reality is, of course, that actually, if you stay calm, your brain will function well and you will perform well. In terms of the parents, the advice is the same, that a happy child will perform well. If you send them out with a look of anxiety in your face, now, darling, there's no pressure, but we've remortgaged the house for your education.
No.
You know, that won't help.
No.
And so make sure that actually you stay calm and crucially, that you remember that your job is to make sure that you parent your child and you parent them to a happy future. Mm. And so however the exam results go, you're still a parent and you're still steering them towards a happy future. So keep that in mind. Let them keep the stakes low, but actually perform really well.
Okay. Dr. Neil Hopkin, thank you so much. So much wisdom there today. Honestly, I'm going to take some of those snippets. And you can find Dr. Neil Hopkin at Fortis Education. Make sure you tune in to Afternoons with Helen Farmer every weekday at 2 p.m.
You've been listening to a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. To enjoy lots more from Dubai Eye in the United Arab Emirates, just go to dubaieye1038.com or find them wherever you normally get your podcasts.